His rage was out of control. He hated the white man. One day, he took a gun. He just wanted to kill. Next on this edition of It's Supernatural.
Centuries have come and gone, offering wisdom and understanding throughout the ages. Today, there should be nothing beyond one's power to discover. And yet, the strange, unusual, and mysterious world of the supernatural defies understanding. Stay tuned for a unique and powerful investigation into a curious, undiscovered universe only on It's Supernatural.
Hi, I'm Sid Roth, your investigative reporter. I'm here with Ben Kinchlow. What causes a human to take a gun and want to destroy the life of another human? It's rage. What causes rage? It's anger. What causes anger? It's hurts. It's offenses. I mean, you can't live in this life without being hurt. Well, Ben Kinchlow, what caused that type of anger where you didn't care the consequence, you didn't care that you might die, you didn't care anything, you just had so much rage you wanted to kill that man? It didn't start there. Where did it start?
You know, they send people to prison for homicidal acts. They put people in units where they have them confined by virtue of being considered psychologically unfit to inhabit society. And what happens is, barring some kind of chemical problem, it generally results from people who have unmanaged rage. Now, I realize that sounds like a psychologist, you know, talking, but right. The truth of the matter is, everyone builds in their life little pockets of rage, and if you don't deal with these little pockets of rage, eventually they get to the point where they spill over and they result in negative actions. Generally speaking, something that tends toward violence.
I'm going to take you back, a child. Tell me one real hurtful thing that happened to you that might pop into your mind.
Well, if you live in a situation where you understand for some reason that you have nothing to do with, that you have no control over whatsoever, that there's something wrong with you, and you don't understand what it is, and nobody can tell you exactly why it's wrong to be where you are. I mean, you have to get off the sidewalk when certain kind of people come. You have to say yes, sir, and no, sir, to children your own age. People treat you as though you were not there. They talk about you and your people right in front of you as though you weren't, as though you didn't exist. I mean, this is why, you know, a lot of menials, I guess you'd call them, servants, learn things about people that they work for that they would never tell anybody else because they talk about you as though you aren't there.
Now, I'm a Jew, and I remember as a child hearing slurs about me because I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear, but most of them were never done to my face, that's what you're saying. Did you ever hear things about being black to your face?
I mean, being black, and when I was growing up, was an insult. I mean, now it's something like, well, you know, I'm black and I'm proud, or, you know, it's black and beautiful, and we're African-Americans, that sort of thing. But back when I was a young person growing up, I mean, the worst insult you could call somebody was black. I mean, we got called nigger all the time. Nigger was just part of the vocabulary. I mean, I grew up hearing that, you know. You know what? You're a nigger and I'm not. I mean, that was just part of growing up. It was part of who you are. But if you really wanted to insult somebody, you called him a black nigger. And when you called him black, then that was an invitation to fight if it was somebody of your own race. Now, if it was somebody else, there wasn't much you could do but kind of hang your head and shuffle. One of the things that comes to my mind so clearly, and it happened to me, you know, some years ago, was I hated the way that children treated my mother. We were taught from the time I was old enough to talk, all adults had a Mr. or Mrs. in front of their name. Now, we didn't know their last names, but we call them Mrs. Mariah or Mr. Coleman, and that was their first names. And then I would hear white kids come up and call my mother by her first name. That was extremely irritating and debilitating.
These things build up, but they really build up when your heart's desire was to be on the football team.
My dad was the number one fan of the Coyotes. That was the name of the town. And I wanted to play football so I could hear my dad come out and root for me. He was such a fan that they actually gave him a megaphone to stand up and root in the stand. And I wanted to play so my dad could see me play. So when I graduated from high school, from eighth grade, they said, where do you want to go to high school? I told them, and they said, well, you can't go there. And I said, well, why not? I graduated here, didn't I? And they said, well, you can't go because you're black. Well, suddenly it dawned on me that all these things that had been said about me as a kid had real negative connotations, and that they could actually impact your life. So I went off to a particular denominational school where I learned that even though people were religious in their orientation, they really didn't care very much about people unless you looked like them. And that was kind of the way it began to grow. And then I got in the military, which is the reason I joined the military, because that was one of the few places that they couldn't openly discriminate against me. And if they did, then I could do something about it. Plus, in the military, they gave you a gun.
Well, you saw one of your first real racial fights, brawls in the military. What was that like?
In Cheyenne, Wyoming, it was quite a different thing. You know, it was the first time I'd actually been involved in a race riot where there was actual physical violence. I mean, we fought individually, but this was the first time I was involved in a collective racial violent confrontation. And it's a pretty scary thing because, you know, everybody's hand is turned against everybody, and you never know who's going to step out of the shadows with a gun or a knife or a rope, and that's the end of your life.
So you come back from the military, conquering hero, and were there any changes in race relations?
You know, man, the worst thing about it, Sid, was when you go overseas and you have promised to defend this country with your life, and you have pledged allegiance to the flag of the United States of America with liberty and justice for all, and you get overseas and find out that everything you've been taught most of your life is a lie. I'm not a member of minority. I got overseas and I found that there was more of them than us, and it was over there I got to be treated like a human being, and I was over there to kill people who were, quote, enemies of my country, and the enemies of my country treated me better than my country. I remember sitting watching television in a foreign country when they were having the school desegregation in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And here I'm in a military uniform, issued the same kind of weapon that I'm watching on television, keeping my people, my color, out of the schools that I pay taxes to support.
So you get back to this country,
I'm standing in a department store, and I've got my uniform on, I've got American dollars in my pocket, I got my little boy who's just been potty trained, and I'm really proud of him, and, you know, you're helping him get along here, and I'm standing in a line, and, you know, he turns to me, pulls on my coat, and he says, Dad, I need to go to potty. Well, this is a great victory, because now we've got him where he doesn't just mess up his pants. He's pulling, saying, I've got to go to the potty. So, that's way to go, son. I rubbed him on the head and said, just a minute. So I step up with a smile on my face to the lady behind the counter, and I said, excuse me, can you tell me where the bathrooms are? You know, and she just looked at me like, what's wrong with you? We don't have bathrooms for colored in this place. And I went, now, what do you want to do? What do? Do you tell the kid, shut up, you don't have to go to the bathroom, hold it till you get home? What do you tell the kid?
What did you?
I said, come with me, son. I took him outside and let him go up against the wall like a dog.
How humiliating. You can understand how this anger, this hurt, this rage is building. We'll be right back after this.
Hello, YouTube. Mishpocha is a Hebrew word. It means family. This is Sid Roth. Welcome to my world, where it's naturally supernatural. If you've been blessed by this show, please subscribe. Then click the bell so you won't miss a single episode of It's Supernatural.
Hello, I'm Sid Roth, your investigative reporter. I'm here with Ben Kinchlow, a black man that he grew up with hurts and anger and rage. He served the United States of America in military service, and he was treated like a human. He gets back, and his son, little son, Nigel, has to use the bathroom. And at that time in the United States, blacks could not use the same bathrooms that whites used. And this just compounded things. How did you feel?
Like, I went to what every person who's ever been discriminated against long enough, they feel this almost uncontrollable urge to smash something, to burn something. It doesn't make a difference whether you are black or white. You know, there are people of every ethnic group that have been discriminated against by other ethnic groups, and they have this same burning rage down inside of them. This is the real core for revolutions. This is the real core for why you have slaughters. I mean, you find, you know, people slaughtered by the tens of thousands. We had thousands of black people killed in this country, but you find the same thing in whatever country you happen to be in. It happened for Japan, China, it happens in... Nothing new under the sun. And it all stems from the fact that people refuse to accept another human being. You know, the Jewish nation has suffered centuries of oppression. I mean, a whole nation was attempted to be wiped out by this same kind of thing. So this thing builds up in people, and unless there is a way to resolve it, you begin to turn this hatred inside, because if you can't express it outwardly, it turns inside, and you start to hate yourself. Alcoholism begins, infidelity begins. You know, I didn't feel like anybody could really love me.
Was there infidelity?
Of course that is. I mean, that.
Why?
I mean, that, because you're looking for somewhere to find love. And even though people say, well, I love you, your wife says I love you, your husband says you love you, you don't really feel love because you don't love yourself. You hate yourself. And so when somebody tells you they love you, you cannot accept that as being valid, because you don't accept the fact that you are valid. What is it to love about me? If I was a lovable person, why am I being treated this way? And women oftentimes become promiscuous, and they do all kinds of things in an attempt to validate their own personal self-worth, their own personal value. And as a result of that, infidelity becomes part and part. Now, one of the things that happens to a minority group is you tend to see the women of the superior group, you know, of the oppressor group, as being a way that you can validate yourself as a valuable person, and B, avenge yourself on your oppressor if you can get one of his women. So therefore,
translate that. What does that mean?
Back in the 40s and 50s, for a black male to have as his paramour a white female, and most particularly a blonde white female, was the epitome of having arrived.
It's the status symbol.
That was a status symbol. Just like now, it's a Bentley or a Rolls Royce or, you know, whatever, the Mercedes, whatever the, or Big Diamond or Armani suits or whatever it is, you have status symbols for.
Did you arrive?
Of course I arrived. You know, I mean, I was, you know, I was an intelligent guy.
And did you feel great about it?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I had arrived. It didn't change what was inside, but at least I felt like I had was getting some revenge on the man, we called him.
Now, tell me about that day that you took a gun, you did not fear the consequence, and all you wanted to do was kill.
When you reach the stage that you have, quote, you know, had enough, when it gets to the point where you have done all the things you know how to do to, quote, manage anger, you finally get to the stage where you just don't give a rip. And at that point, it's when it boils over, and this is where violence erupts. And I don't care what anybody says. There was no law, there was no concept of, well, you'd be sent to prison, you know, you might get the death sentence, you know, the police might shoot you. It didn't matter. Somebody was gonna die that day. And I had a particular person in mind, because this individual had done what I felt was quite, you know, unforgivable.
How did you happen to have a gun?
I bought a gun.
For that purpose?
Oh, yes. You see, I had already taken karate. I was a trained, well, I could do people in with my hands. And the only reason I took karate is because I was going to do people in physically. I wanted to hurt people with my hands. That's why I took karate. And I wanted to teach young black people how to hurt white people with your hands. And that's why I took karate. But this thing, I wanted to kill somebody violently, and the gun was, of course, what everybody associates with violent death.
So you went to see this guy with the gun. What happened?
Walked up and knocked on his door, and I already had it planned in my mind. I knew exactly what I was going to do. I had the safety off. It was an 8-shot automatic wiper. When I picked it up, I was just going to thumb it back, and then it would, every faster you pull the trigger, it would eject another shell into the round. And I knew exactly what I was going to do. As soon as he opened the door, high, right, one shot, it would step back, I would follow him in, I'd shoot two more steps in him, and he would fall on the ground, and then I'd put two on the ground, and then I'd put the third one, the sixth or seventh one.
You had that all rehearsed in your mind?
Oh, it was all in my mind. I knew exactly how it was going to happen. Just so happened, just so happened the guy wasn't home. Just happened that he had been shipped out. He was in the military, and they shipped him out that day.
Well, what a change in destiny. But the hatred is seething. He's starting to read about black militants, and he has a strategy and a plan to inflict hurt on the white man. We'll be back right after this. Hello, I'm Sid Roth, your investigative reporter here with Ben Kinchlow. But before we go back to Ben, let's go to the control room with Janie Duvall. Janie, who's our guest next week?
Sid, did you know that there has been a deliberate cover-up by rabbis so Jewish people would not believe in Jesus?
I know that as a fact, but how deliberate is it?
They would take prophecies. This is about over 1,000 years ago. They would take prophecies that were about Jesus that were in the Old Testament, the Tanakh, and they changed some of the words so it would not look like it was Jesus. And the man you're going to interview has the goods.
There's very few people that know this. I can't wait till next week. Thank you, Janie. And I'm here with Ben Kinchlow. And Ben, the rage that you were going through, it was just a, if you call it a quirk of fate, or you would have spent the rest of your life in prison, or worse, been killed
executed
and executed.
It was cold-blooded murder. That was cold-blooded murder. It was not a crime of passion. It was planned. It was cold-blooded murder. So I went ahead and, you know.
Now, you decided to go the education route. You got yourself educated. You ended up in the who's who of colleges.
Well, I knew that it's not black power or white power that really makes a difference in the world. It's green power. If you have money, then it doesn't make a difference who you are, what ethnic group you belong to. If you have enough money, you can buy your way out of this. And the way you got money, and my kid was going to business and make some money.
What were you going to do with the money? What was the
train
purpose?
Train revolutionaries. I was going to pay black revolutionaries to go down south and teach what we learned in Vietnam and Korea, fighting America's, quote, enemies, unquote. And then I was going to teach these young black hoodlums in these gangs to say, why are you fighting yourselves and killing each other and burning down your own buildings? Go fight the white man, burn down his buildings, and disappear into the countryside. If necessary, we'll ship you to Mississippi, teach you how to live off the countryside. That's who you need to fight. You need to know who your real enemy is, and you need to know why he needs to die, because he's not going to change. So the only way you can make him change is at the point of gun. Might makes right.
And just as that man wasn't there when he had the gun ready to kill him, another man, we call it in Hebrew, beshert, it's a destiny, it's meant to be. Another man comes into his life who is a martial arts or karate expert, and of course you're into karate, so you become friends over that, but he was taking this friendship, and he's a white man. Why would you even want to be involved with this white man?
I was teaching a class, and you have to understand that I was the only, like it was three black guys on this campus that I was on, and I was the oldest one, and I had a black belt in karate, third degree black belt, and when you are, once you get to a black belt, you can wear an all black gi, and everybody else has to wear a white gi with a white belt, and when you come in, you have to bow down to the master of the dojo, which was me, and if you can imagine 100-some-odd white kids coming out and bowing down to this big afro-ed mustachioed black guy with the black gi on,
that's a power trip. That was better than the blonde.
Oh,
that was quite a trip.
And if you got a blonde to boot, I mean, then you had a real power trip going on. And that was what was going on in my life. And so this guy who was one of my assistants, I could order him around and, so it was like a real power trip going on. But he had something different about this guy. I couldn't figure out what was different about this guy. I remember having lunch at his house. He invited me over to have dinner with my wife and my children and my mother and my father. His wife had prepared this elaborate dinner, and I'm sitting here with this violent Afrocentric, death to the white man and pounding on his table. And I looked over here, and this guy was tears running down his cheek. And I thought, I got you now. cracker. I mean, I got you now, you honky so-and-so.
But your family's there. What is this?
What? My family?
Why in front of your family?
My family knew the rage that was going on. I had thrown a man out of my mother's house for walking in without knocking. She, you know, some insurance guy walks into my mother's house, doesn't knock on the door, just walks in and starts going, "Hey, Joel, I'm here." You know, and I jumped up, man, and I was 6'5", had a 30-degree black belt, had this huge Afro Fu Manchu mustache, you know, and I had this big old dashiki hanging down around my knees. I jumped up and I told him, "If you don't get out of my house," and he immediately got it back out, and, you know, "Don't walk in my mother's house without knocking. That's the ultimate disrespect." And so this was the rage that everybody knew I had. So, it was like, it wasn't like I was polite in front of my family, you know. I mean, that rage, hatred doesn't stay where you aim it. It permeates every aspect of your life. And that's why I was pounding on his table. When I saw this guy crying, I thought, "I've got him now."
Why was he crying?
Because I was hurting.
Did it dawn on you?
Yeah. Suddenly I realized, this guy's not crying because I've ruined his wife's dinner party or because I've insulted him or because I've done anything. This guy literally is weeping because I'm in pain. And he knew I was in pain. That's what anger is. Anger is a Band-Aid over pain. It is, that's how real hurt manifests itself.
But he's a white man. He's your enemy.
Yeah. And that's why I didn't understand. And so I wanted to know, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with this guy?
So I
asked him.
What did he say?
He said, "I have a personal relationship with God." Come on. How do you have a personal relationship with first cause, with ultimate mind, with the universal clockmaker? Give me a break. How do you have a personal relationship with God? He said, "Through Jesus Christ." And I went, "Yeah, right. A dead Jew who got himself killed for what he believed, and you're telling me that some dead guy is going to help me out?"
A few days later, something very supernatural happened to you.
I couldn't argue. I could argue his theology, but I couldn't argue with the fact that it was something different about that guy. So I was driving around in a car, 80 miles an hour, smoking cigarettes, 3 packs a day, filthy mouth, on my way to commit adultery that very night. Wasn't even thinking about that. And all of a sudden, I heard myself singing some old spiritual, and I thought, "I'm losing my mind. I'm losing
my
mind."
Let me hear a tiny bit of that song.
"My Heavenly Father watches over me." That was all that just kept coming out of my mind. And I remembered some of the things that had happened. I should have been dead. I was waiting to kill a guy with a knife. He had a gun. Another time, I was waiting to kill somebody. Got drunk, fell asleep. Somebody saved my life. Third time, automobile turned over, killed the guy that was driving, bashed up the girl that was with him. I was in the back seat, passed out, got out of the whole thing with just a scar on my arm. My Heavenly Father watches over me. And so I just prayed a very simple prayer. "God, if you really are out there, and if this Jesus is who John says he is," I said, "then come into my life and change." I said, "but don't give me none of this religious jazz. I got enough of that stuff going on making me miserable. If you're real and you can do something, change my life."
What happened?
Changed my life. Instantly, dramatically, permanently. Didn't give me religion. Changed my life.
I am a white Jew. What do you think of me?
Well, if you hadn't said that, all I would have noticed was that you have a particular shade of blue about your eyes. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't bother me. I'm colorblind now. It's irrelevant. What color you are, you know, what language you speak, really just doesn't matter anymore. Because now I know who I am because of who he is. And when he told me, when I found out who he was, and he showed me who I was, then everybody else falls right into place. So white, Jew.
You love people, don't you?
Well, that's because when you meet this Jesus we're talking about, something supernatural happens.
Something supernatural happens. Your Heavenly Father's looking over you. Did you know that? Your Heavenly Father is looking over you. It's time that you got close to Him through the Jewish Messiah, Jesus. Pray now. You'll see. He's looking over you. He's this close to you. He's this close to them.
He's closer than that.